suspects involved the use of an extremely bright electric light in the small, white-walled cell or box in which the accused is being held, a light which is never extinguished. The electricity saved by the economies of schoolchildren and housewives. Your eyelids become inflamed, which is very painful, and then in the interrogation room searchlights are again directed into your eyes. 14. Here is another imaginative trick. On the eve of May the 1st, 1933, in the Khabarovsk GPU, for 12 hours, all night, Chebotarayev was not interrogated, no, but was simply kept in a continual state of being led to interrogation. Hey, you, hands behind your back! They led him out of the cell, up the stairs, quickly, into the interrogator's office. The guard left, but the interrogator, without asking one single question, and sometimes without even allowing Chebotarayev to sit down, would pick up the telephone. Take away the prisoner from 107! And so they came to get him and took him back to his cell. No sooner had he lain down on his board bunk than the lock rattled. Chebotarayev, to interrogation, hands behind your back. And when he got there, take away the prisoner from 107. For that matter, the methods of bringing pressure to bear can begin a long time before the interrogator's office. 15. Prison begins with the box, in other words, what amounts to a closet or packing case. The human being who has just been taken from freedom, still in a state of inner turmoil, ready to explain, to argue, to struggle, is, when he first sets foot in prison, clapped into a box, which sometimes has a lamp and a place where he can sit down, but which sometimes is dark and constructed in such a way that he can only stand up, and even then is squeezed against the door. And he is held there for several hours, or for half a day, or a day. During those hours he knows absolutely nothing. Will he perhaps be confined there all his life? He has never in his life encountered anything like this, and he cannot guess at the outcome. Those first hours are passing when everything inside him is still ablaze from the unstilled storm in his heart. Some become despondent, and that's the time to subject them to their first interrogation. Others become angry, and that, too, is all to the good, for they may insult the interrogator right at the start or make a slip, and it will be all the easier to cook up their case. 16. When boxes were in short supply, they used to have another method. In the Novocherkassk NKVD, Yelena Strutinskaya was forced to remain seated on a stool in the corridor for 6 days, in such a way that she did not lean against anything, did not sleep, did not fall off, and did not get up from it. 6 days. Just try to sit that way for 6 hours. Then again, as a variation, the prisoner can be forced to sit on a tall chair, of the kind used in laboratories, so that his feet do not reach the floor. They become very numb in this position. He is left sitting that way from 8 to 10 hours. Or else, during the interrogation itself, when the prisoner is out in plain view, he can be forced to sit in this way, as far forward as possible on the front edge. Move further forward, further still, of the chair, so that he is under painful pressure during the entire interrogation. He is not allowed to stir for several hours. Is that all? Yes, that's all. Just try it yourself. 17. Depending on local conditions, a divisional pit can be substituted for the box, as was done in the Gorokhovets army camps during World War II. The prisoner was pushed into such a pit, 10 feet in depth, 6.5 feet in diameter, and beneath the open sky, rain or shine, this pit was for several days both his cell and his latrine, and 10.5 ounces of bread and water were lowered to him on a cord. Imagine yourself in this situation just after you have been arrested, when you're all in a boil. Either identical orders to all special branches of the Red Army, or else the similarities of their situations in the field, led to broad use of this method. Thus, in the 36th Motorized Infantry Division, a unit which took part in the Battle of Khalkhin-Gol, and which was encamped in the Mongolian desert in 1941, a newly arrested prisoner was, without explanation, given a spade by Chief of the Special Branch Samulyev, and ordered to dig a pit the exact dimensions of a grave. Here is a hybridization of physical and psychological methods. When the prisoner had dug deeper than his own waist, they ordered him to stop and sit down on the bottom. His head was no longer visible. One guard kept watch over several such pits, and it was as though he were surrounded by empty space. This evidently is a Mongolian theme. In the magazine Neva, March 15, 1914, page 218, there is a drawing of a Mongolian prison. Each prisoner is shut in a separate trunk, with a small opening for his head or for food. A jailer patrols between the trunks. They kept the accused in this desert with no protection from the Mongolian sun and with no warm clothing against the cold of the night, but no torches. Why waste effort on tortures? The ration they gave was 3.5 ounces of bread per day and 1 glass of water. Lieutenant Chulpenyev, a giant, a boxer, 21 years old, spent a month imprisoned this way. Within 10 days he was swarming with lice. After 15 days he was summoned to interrogation for the first time. 18. The accused could be compelled to stand on his knees, not in some figurative sense, but literally, on his knees without sitting back on his heels, and with his back upright. People could be compelled to kneel in the interrogator's office or the corridor for 12, or even 24 or 48 hours. The interrogator himself could go home, sleep, amuse himself in one way or another. This was an organized system. Watch was kept over the kneeling prisoner, and the guards worked in shifts. That, after all, is how somebody's career was launched, standing guard over a prisoner on his knees. And now, in all probability, that somebody has attained high rank, and his children are already grown up. What kind of prisoner was most vulnerable to such treatment? One already broken, already inclined to surrender. It was also a good method to use with women. Ivanov Razumnik reports a variation of it. Having set young Lord Kipanitsi on his knees, the interrogator urinated in his face. And what happened? Unbroken by anything else, Lord Kipanitsi was broken by this. Which shows that the method also worked well on proud people. 19. Then there is the method of simply compelling a prisoner to stand there. This can be arranged so that the accused stands only while being interrogated, because that, too, exhausts and breaks a person down. It can be set up in another way, so that the prisoner sits down during interrogation, but is forced to stand up between interrogations. A watch is set over him, and the guards see to it that he doesn't lean against the wall, and if he goes to sleep and falls over, he is given a kick and straightened up. Sometimes even one day of standing is enough to deprive a person of all his strength, and to force him to testify to anything at all. 20. During all these tortures, which involved standing for 3, 4, and 5 days, they ordinarily deprived a person of water. The most natural thing of all is to combine the psychological and physical methods. It is also natural to combine all the preceding methods with 21. Sleeplessness, which they quite failed to appreciate in medieval times. They did not understand how narrow are the limits within which a human being can preserve his personality intact. Sleeplessness, yes, combined with standing, thirst, bright light, terror, and the unknown. What other tortures are needed? Befogs the reason, undermines the will, and the human being ceases to be himself, to be his own I. As in Chekhov's I Want to Sleep. But there it was much easier, for there the girl could lie down and slip into lapses of consciousness, which even in just a minute would revive and refresh the brain. A person deprived of sleep acts half unconsciously, or altogether unconsciously, so that his testimony cannot be held against him. Just picture a foreigner who knows no Russian in this muddled state being given something to sign. Under these conditions, the Bavarian Jupp Aschenbrenner signed a document admitting that he had worked on wartime gas vans. It was not until 1954 in camp that he was finally able to prove that at the time he had been in Munich, studying to become an electric welder. They used to say, "You are not truthful in your testimony, and therefore you will not be allowed to sleep." Sometimes, as a refinement, instead of making the prisoner stand up, they made him sit down on a soft sofa, which made him want to sleep all the more. The jailer on duty sat next to him on the same sofa and kicked him every time his eyes began to shut. Here is how one victim, who had just sat out days in a box infested with bedbugs, describes his feelings after this torture. Chill from great loss of blood. Irises of the eyes dried out as if someone were holding a red-hot iron in front of them. Tongue swollen from thirst and prickling as from a hedgehog at the slightest movement. Throat racked by spasms of swallowing. Sleeplessness was a great form of torture. It left no visible marks and could not provide grounds for complaint, even if an inspection, something unheard of anyway, were to strike on the morrow. Inspection, by the way, was so totally impossible, and had so emphatically never taken place, that in 1953, when real inspectors entered the cell of former Minister of State Security Abakumov, himself a prisoner by that time, he roared with laughter, thinking their appearance was a trick intended to confuse him. "They didn't let you sleep? Well, after all, this is not supposed to be a vacation resort. The security officials were awake, too. They would catch up on their sleep during the day." One can say that sleeplessness became the universal method in the organs. From being one among many tortures, it became an integral part of the system of state security. It was the cheapest possible method, and did not require the posting of sentries. In all the interrogation prisons, the prisoners were forbidden to sleep even 1 minute, from a valet till taps. In Sukhanovka and several other prisons used specifically for interrogation, the cot was folded into the wall during the day. In others, the prisoners were simply forbidden to lie down, and even to close their eyes while seated. Since the major interrogations were all conducted at night, it was automatic. Whoever was undergoing interrogation got no sleep for at least 5 days and nights. Saturday and Sunday nights, the interrogators themselves tried to get some rest. 22. The above method was further implemented by an assembly line of interrogators. Not only were you not allowed to sleep, but for 3 or 4 days shifts of interrogators kept up a continuous interrogation. 23. The bedbug-infested box has already been mentioned. In the dark closet made of wooden planks, there were hundreds, maybe even thousands, of bedbugs, which had been allowed to multiply. The guards removed the prisoner's jacket or field shirt, and immediately the hungry bedbugs assaulted him, crawling onto him from the walls or falling off the ceiling. At first he waged war with them strenuously, crushing them on his body and on the walls, suffocated by their stink. But after several hours he weakened and let them drink his blood without a murmur. 24. Punishment cells. No matter how hard it was in the ordinary cell, the punishment cells were always worse, and on return from there the ordinary cell always seemed like paradise. In the punishment cell a human being was systematically worn down by starvation, and also usually by cold. In Sukhanovka prison there were also hot punishment cells. For example, the Lefortovo punishment cells were entirely unheated. There were radiators in the corridor only, and in this heated corridor the guards on duty walked in felt boots and padded jackets. The prisoner was forced to undress down to his underwear, and sometimes to his undershorts, and he was forced to spend from 3 to 5 days in the punishment cell without moving, since it was so confining. He received hot gruel on the 3rd day only. For the first few minutes you were convinced you'd not be able to last an hour, but by some miracle a human being would indeed sit out his 5 days, perhaps acquiring in the course of it an illness that would last him the rest of his life. There were various aspects to punishment cells, as, for instance, dampness and water. In the Chernovtsi prison after the war, Masha G. was kept barefooted for 2 hours and up to her ankles in icy water. Confess! She was 18 years old, and how she feared for her feet. She was going to have to live with them a long time. 25. Should one consider it a variation of the punishment cell when a prisoner was locked in an alcove? As long ago as 1933, this was one of the ways they tortured S.A. Chebotaryev in the Khabarovsk GPU. They locked him naked in a concrete alcove in such a way that he could neither bend his knees nor straighten up and change the position of his arms, nor turn his head. And that was not all. They began to drip cold water onto his scalp, a classic torture, which then ran down his body in rivulets. They did not inform him, of course, that this would go on for only 24 hours. It was awful enough, at any rate, for him to lose consciousness, and he was discovered the next day apparently dead. He came to on a hospital cot. They had brought him out of his faint with spirits of ammonia, caffeine, and body massage. At first he had no recollection of where he had been or what had happened. For a whole month he was useless even for interrogation. We may be so bold as to assume that this alcove and dripping device had not been devised for Chebatariev alone. In 1949, my Dnepropetrovsk acquaintance had been similarly confined, without the dripping attachment, however. On a line joining Khabarovsk and Dnepropetrovsk, and over a period of 16 years, were there not other such points as well? 26. Starvation has already been mentioned in combination with other methods, nor was it an unusual method to starve the prisoner into confession. Actually, the starvation technique, like interrogation at night, was an integral element in the entire system of coercion. The miserly prison bread ration, amounting to 10.5 ounces in the peacetime year of 1933, and to 1 pound in 1945 in the Lubyanka, and permitting or prohibiting food parcels from one's family and access to the commissary, were universally applied to everyone. But there was also the technique of intensified hunger. For example, Chulpenyev was kept for a month on 3.5 ounces of bread, after which, when he had just been brought in from the pit, the interrogator Sokol placed in front of him a pot of thick borscht and half a loaf of white bread sliced diagonally. What does it matter, one might ask, how it was sliced? But Chulpenyev, even today, will insist that it was really sliced very attractively. However, he was not given a thing to eat. How ancient it all is, how medieval, how primitive. The only thing new about it was that it was applied in a socialist society. Others, too, tell about such tricks. They were often tried. But we are going to cite another case involving Chebatariev, because it combined so many methods. They put him in the interrogator's office for 72 hours, and the only thing he was allowed was to be taken to the toilet. For the rest, they allowed him neither food nor drink, even though there was water in a carafe right next to him. Nor was he permitted to sleep. Throughout, there were 3 interrogators in the office, working in shifts. One kept writing something, silently, without disturbing the prisoner. The second slept on the sofa, and the third walked around the room, and as soon as Chebatariev fell asleep, beat him instantly. Then they switched roles. Maybe they themselves were being punished for failure to deliver. And then, all of a sudden, they brought Chebatariev a meal. Fat Ukrainian borscht, a chop, fried potatoes, and red wine in a crystal carafe. But because Chebatariev had had an aversion to alcohol all his life, he refused to drink the wine, and the interrogator couldn't go too far in forcing him to, because that would have spoiled the whole game. After he had eaten, they said to him, "Now here's what you have testified to in the presence of 2 witnesses. Sign here." In other words, he was to sign what had been silently composed by 1 interrogator in the presence of another, who had been asleep, and a 3rd, who had been actively working. On the very first page, Chebatariev learned he had been on intimate terms with all the leading Japanese generals, and that he had received espionage assignments from all of them. He began to cross out whole pages. They beat him up and threw him out. Blaginin, another Chinese Eastern Railroad man, arrested with him, was put through the same thing. But he drank the wine, and in a state of pleasant intoxication, signed the confession, and was shot. Even 1 tiny glass can have an enormous effect on a famished man, and that was a whole carafe. 27. Beatings, of a kind that leave no marks. They use rubber truncheons, and they use wooden mallets and small sandbags. It is very, very painful when they hit a bone. For example, an interrogator's jackboot on the shin, where the bone lies just beneath the skin. They beat Brigade Commander Karpunich Braven for 21 days in a row. And today, he says, "Even after 30 years, all my bones ache, and my head too." In recollecting his own experience and the stories of others, he counts up to 52 methods of torture. Here is one. They grip the hand in a special vice so that the prisoner's palm lies flat on the desk, and then they hit the joints with the thin edge of a ruler, and one screams. Should we single out particularly the technique by which teeth are knocked out? They knocked out 8 of Karpunivsky's. In the case of the secretary of the Karelian Provincial Party Committee, G. Kuprianov, arrested in 1949, some of the teeth they knocked out were just ordinary ones of no particular account, but others were gold. At first they gave him a receipt that said his gold teeth were being kept for him, and then they caught themselves just in time and took away his receipt. As everyone knows, a blow of the fist in the solar plexus, catching the victim in the middle of a breath, leaves no mark whatever. The Lefortovo Colonel Sidorov, in the post-war period, used to take a penalty kick with his overshoes at the dangling genitals of male prisoners. Soccer players, who at one time or another have been hit in the groin by a ball, know what that kind of blow is like. There is no pain comparable to it, and ordinarily the recipient loses consciousness. In 1918, the Moscow Revolutionary Tribunal convicted the former Tsarist jailer Bondar. The most extreme measure of his cruelty that was cited was the accusation that, in one case, he had struck a political prisoner with such force that his eardrum had burst. 28. In the Novorossiysk NKVD, they invented a machine for squeezing fingernails. As a result, it could be observed later at transit prisons that many of those from Novorossiysk had lost their fingernails. 29. And what about the straitjacket? 30. And breaking the prisoner's back, as in that same Khabarovsk GPU in 1933. 31. Or bridling, also known as the swan dive. This was a Sukhanovka method, also used in Arkhangel, where the interrogator Ivkov applied it in 1940. A long piece of rough toweling was inserted between the prisoner's jaws, like a bridle. The ends were then pulled back over his shoulders and tied to his heels. Just try lying on your stomach like a wheel with your spine breaking and without water and food for 2 days. Is it necessary to go on with the list? Is there much left to enumerate? What won't idle, well-fed, unfeeling people invent? Brother mine, do not condemn those who, finding themselves in such a situation, turned out to be weak and confessed to more than they should have. Do not be the first to cast a stone at them. But here's the point. Neither these methods, nor even the lightest methods of all, are needed to wring testimony from the majority. For iron jaws to grip lambs who are unprepared and longing to return to their warm hearths, the relationship of forces to situations is too unequal. Oh, in how new a light does our past life appear when re-examined in the interrogator's office, abounding in dangers like an African jungle, and we had considered it so simple. You, A, and your friend, B, have known each other for years and have complete faith in one another. When you met, you spoke out boldly about political matters, large and small. No one else was present. There was no one who could have overheard you, and you have not denounced each other, not at all. But at this point, for some reason, you, A, have been marked, hauled out of the herd by the ears, and arrested. And for some reason, well, maybe not without a denunciation on somebody's part, and not without your apprehensions as to the fate of your loved ones, and not without a certain lack of sleep, and not without a bit of punishment cell, you have decided to write yourself off, but at the same time not to betray anyone else at any price. You have therefore confessed in 4 depositions and signed them, declaring yourself to be a sworn enemy of Soviet power, because you used to tell jokes about the leader, because you thought there should be a choice of candidates at elections, because you went into the voting booth only in order to cross out the name of the only candidate, and would have done so except there was no ink in the inkwell, and because there was a 16-meter band on your radio on which you tried to catch parts of Western broadcasts through the jamming. Your own tenor has been assured, yet your ribs have remained whole, and so far you have not caught pneumonia. You have not sold anyone out, and it seems to you that you have worked things out sensibly. You have already informed your cellmates that, in your opinion, your interrogation is probably coming to an end. But lo and behold, admiring his own handwriting and with deliberation, the interrogator begins to fill out deposition number 5. Question. Were you friendly with B? Answer. Yes. Question. Were you frank with him about politics? Answer. No, no, I did not trust him. Question. But you met often? Answer. Not very. Question. What does that mean, not very? According to testimony from your neighbours, he was at your house on such and such a day, and on such and such just in the past month. Was he? Answer. Maybe. Question. And it was observed that on these occasions, as always, you did not drink, you did not make any noise, you spoke very quietly, and you couldn't be overheard even in the corridor? Well, friends, drink up, break bottles, curse at the top of your lungs. On that basis, you will be considered reliable. Answer. Well, what of it? Question. And you used to visit him, too, and you said to him on the phone, for example, "We spent such an interesting evening." Then they saw you on the street at an intersection. You were standing there together in the cold for half an hour, and you both had gloomy faces and dissatisfied expressions. In fact, they even took photographs of you during that meeting. The technological resources of agents, my friends. The technology of agents. So what did you talk about during these meetings? What about? That's a leading question. Your first idea is to say that you've forgotten what you talked about. Are you really obliged to remember? So, you've forgotten your first conversation, and the second one too, and the third, and even your interesting evening, and that time at the intersection, and your conversations with C, and your conversations with D. No, you think, I forgot is not the way out. You will be unable to maintain that position, and your mind, still shocked by your arrest, in the grip of fear, muddled by sleeplessness and hunger, seeks a way out. How to play it shrewdly in a manner that will have some verisimilitude and outsmart the interrogator? What about? It is fine if you talked about hockey. That, friends, is in all cases the least troublesome. Or about women, or even about science. Then you can repeat what was said. Science is not too far removed from hockey, but in our time everything to do with science is classified information, and they may get you for a violation of the decree on revealing state secrets. But what if you did in actual fact talk about the latest arrests in the city, or about the collective farms? Of course, critically, for who has anything good to say about them? Or about reducing the rate of pay for piecework? The fact remains that you frowned for half an hour at the intersection. What were you talking about there? Maybe B has already been arrested. The interrogator assures you that he has been, and that he has already given evidence against you, and that they're about to bring him in for a confrontation with you. Maybe he is sitting home very calmly and quietly, but they might very well bring him in for questioning, and then they will find out from him what you were frowning about for half an hour at that intersection. At this point, too late. You have come to understand that, because of the way life is, you and he ought to have reached an agreement every time you parted and remembered clearly what you were going to say if you were asked what you had talked about that day. Then, regardless of interrogations, your testimony and his would agree. But you had not made any such agreement. You had, unfortunately, not understood what kind of a jungle you lived in. Should you say that you were talking about going on a fishing trip? But then B might say that there was never any discussion of fishing, that you talked about correspondence school courses. In that case, instead of causing the investigation to ease up a bit, you would only tie the noose tighter. What about? What about? What about? And the idea flashes through your mind, is it a brilliant or a fatal one, that you ought to come as close as you can to the truth of what was actually said, of course rounding off the sharp edges and skipping the dangerous parts. After all, people say that when you lie, you should always stay as close to the truth as possible. And maybe B will guess what's up and say approximately the same thing, and then your testimony will coincide in some respects, and they will leave you in peace. Many years later, you will come to understand that this was not really a wise idea, and that it is much smarter to play the role of someone so improbably imbecile that he can't remember one single day of his life, even at the risk of being beaten. But you have been kept awake for 3 days. You have hardly strength enough to follow the course of your own thoughts and maintain an imperturbable expression. And you don't have even a minute to think things over. Suddenly, two interrogators, for they enjoy visiting one another, are at you. What were you talking about? What about? What about? And you testify. We were talking about collective farms, to the effect that not everything had as yet been set to rights on them, but it soon would be. We talked about the lowering of peace rates. And what in particular did you say about them? That you were delighted they had been reduced? But that wasn't the way people normally talked. It was too implausible. And so as to make it seem an altogether believable conversation, you concede that you complained just a little that they were putting on the squeeze a bit with peace rates. The interrogator writes down the deposition himself, translating it into his own language. At this meeting, we slandered party and government policy in the field of wages. And someday B is going to accuse you. Oh, you blabbermouth, and I said we were making plans to go fishing. But you tried to outsmart your interrogator. You have a quick, abstruse mind. You are an intellectual, and you outsmarted yourself. In Crime and Punishment, Porfiry Petrovich makes a surprisingly astute remark to Raskolnikov, to the effect that he could have been found out only by someone who had himself gone through that same cat-and-mouse game, implying, so to speak, I don't even have to construct my own version with you intellectuals. You will put it together yourselves and bring it to me all wrapped up. Yes, that's so. An intellectual cannot reply with the delightful incoherence of Chekhov's malefactor. He is bound to try to build up in logical form the whole story he is being accused of, no matter how much falsehood it contains. But the interrogator butcher isn't interested in logic. He just wants to catch two or three phrases. He knows what he wants, and as for us, we are totally unprepared for anything. From childhood on, we are educated and trained for our own profession, for our civil duties, for military service, to take care of our bodily needs, to behave well, even to appreciate beauty. Well, this last not really all that much. But neither our education, nor our upbringing, nor our experience prepares us in the slightest for the greatest trial of our lives, being arrested for nothing and interrogated about nothing. Novels, plays, films. Their authors should themselves be forced to drink the cup of gulag to the bottom. Depict the types one meets in the offices of interrogators as chivalrous guardians of truth and humanitarianism, as our loving fathers. We are exposed to lectures on everything under the sun, and are even herded in to listen to them. But no one is going to lecture to us about the true and extended significance of the criminal code, and the codes themselves are not on open shelves in our libraries, nor sold at newsstands, nor do they fall into the hands of the heedless young. It seems a virtual fairy tale that somewhere, at the ends of the earth, an accused person can avail himself of a lawyer's help. This means having beside you in the most difficult moment of your life a clear-minded ally who knows the law. The principle of our interrogation consists further in depriving the accused of even a knowledge of the law. An indictment is presented. And here, incidentally, is how it's presented. Sign it. It's not true. Sign. But I'm not guilty of anything. It turns out that you are being indicted under the provisions of Articles 5810, Part 2, and 5811 of the Criminal Code of the Russian Republic. Sign. But what do these sections say? Let me read the code. I don't have it. Well, get it from your department head. He doesn't have it either. Sign. But I want to see it. You are not supposed to see it. It isn't written for you, but for us. You don't need it. I'll tell you what it says. These sections spell out exactly what you are guilty of. And anyway, at this point, your signature doesn't mean that you agree with the indictment, but that you've read it, that it's been presented to you. All of a sudden, a new combination of letters, UPK, flashes by on one of the pieces of paper. Your sense of caution is aroused. What's the difference between the UPK and the UK, the criminal code? If you've been lucky enough to catch the interrogator when he is in a good mood, he will explain it to you. The UPK is the Code of Criminal Procedure. What? This means that there are two distinct codes, not just one, of whose contents you are completely ignorant, even as you are being trampled under their provisions. Since that time, 10 years have passed, then 15. The grass has grown thick over the grave of my youth, I served out my term, and even eternal exile as well. And nowhere, neither in the cultural education sections of the camps, nor in district libraries, nor even in medium-sized cities, have I seen with my own eyes, held in my own hands, been able to buy, obtain, or even ask for the code of Soviet law. Those familiar with our atmosphere of suspicion will understand why it was impossible to ask for the code in a people's court or in the district executive committee. Your interest in the code would be an extraordinary phenomenon. You must either be preparing to commit a crime or be trying to cover your tracks. And of the hundreds of prisoners I knew who had gone through interrogation and trial, and more than once too, who had served sentences in camp and in exile, none had ever seen the code or held it in his hand. It was only when both codes were 35 years old and on the point of being replaced by new ones that I saw them, two little paperback brothers, the UK or Criminal Code and the UPK or Code of Criminal Procedure, on a newsstand in the Moscow subway. Because they were outdated, it had been decided to release them for general circulation. I read them today, touched with emotion. For example, the UPK, the Code of Criminal Procedure. Article 136. The interrogator does not have the right to extract testimony or a confession from an accused by means of compulsion and threats. It was as though they had foreseen it. Article 111. The interrogator is obliged to establish clearly all the relevant facts, both those tending toward acquittal and any which might lessen the accused's measure of guilt. But it was I who helped establish Soviet power in October. It was I who shot Kolchak. I took part in the dispossession of the kulaks. I saved the state 10 million rubles in lowered production costs. I was wounded twice in the war. I have 3 orders and decorations. You're not being tried for that. History, the bared teeth of the interrogator. Whatever good you may have done has nothing to do with the case. Article 139. The accused has the right to set forth his testimony in his own hand and to demand the right to make corrections in the deposition written by the interrogator. Oh, if we had only known that in time. But what I should say is, if that were only the way it really was, we were always vainly imploring the interrogator not to write my repulsive, slanderous fabrications instead of my mistaken statements, or not to write our underground weapons arsenal instead of my rusty Finnish knife. If only the defendants had first been taught some prison science, if only interrogation had been run through first in rehearsal and only afterward for real. They didn't, after all, play that interrogation game with the second-termers of 1948. It would have gotten them nowhere. But newcomers had no experience, no knowledge, and there was no one from whom to seek advice. The loneliness of the accused. That was one more factor in the success of unjust interrogation. The entire apparatus threw its full weight on one lonely and inhibited will. From the moment of his arrest and throughout the entire shock period of the interrogation, the prisoner was, ideally, to be kept entirely alone. In his cell, in the corridor, on the stairs, in the offices. He was not supposed to encounter others like himself, in order to avoid the risk of his gleaning a bit of sympathy, advice, support from someone's smile or glance. The organs did everything to blot out for him his future and distort his present. To lead him to believe that his friends and family had all been arrested and that material proof of his guilt had been found. It was their habit to exaggerate their power to destroy him and those he loved, as well as their authority to pardon, which the organs didn't even have. They pretended that there was some connection between the sincerity of a prisoner's repentance and a reduction in his sentence or an easing of the camp regimen. No such connection ever existed. While the prisoner was still in a state of shock and torment and totally beside himself, they tried to get from him, very quickly, as many irreparably damaging items of evidence as possible, and to implicate with him as many totally innocent persons as possible. Some defendants became so depressed in these circumstances that they even asked not to have the depositions read to them. They could not stand hearing them. They asked merely to be allowed to sign them, just to sign and get it over with. Only after all this was over would the prisoner be released from solitary into a large cell, where, in belated desperation, he would discover and count over his mistakes one by one. How was it possible not to make mistakes in such a duel? Who could have failed to make a mistake? We said that, ideally, he was to be kept alone. However, in the overcrowded prisons of 1937, and for that matter of 1945 as well, this ideal of solitary confinement for a newly arrested defendant could not be attained. Almost from his first hours, the prisoner was in fact in a terribly overcrowded common cell. But there were virtues to this arrangement, too, which more than made up for its flaws. The overcrowding of the cells not only took the place of the tightly confined solitary box, but also assumed the character of a first-class torture in itself, one that was particularly useful because it continued for whole days and weeks, with no effort on the part of the interrogators. The prisoners tortured the prisoners. The jailer pushed so many prisoners into the cell that not everyone had even a piece of floor. Some were sitting on others' feet, and people walked on people and couldn't even move about at all. Thus, in the Kishinev KPZs, cells for preliminary detention, in 1945, they pushed 18 prisoners into a cell designed for the solitary confinement of one person. In Lugansk, in 1937, it was 15. And the interrogation there lasted 8 to 10 months at a time. Maybe Klim, Voroshilov, had one of these to himself, said the fellows there. Was he, in fact, ever imprisoned? And in 1938, Ivanov Razumnik found 140 prisoners in a standard butyrki cell intended for 25, with toilets so overburdened that prisoners were taken to the toilet only once a day, sometimes at night. And the same thing was true of their outdoor walk as well. That same year in the butyrki, those newly arrested who had already been processed through the bath and the boxes sat on the stairs for several days at a stretch, waiting for departing prisoner transports to leave and release space in the cells. T. Blank V. had been imprisoned in the butyrki 7 years earlier, in 1931, and says that it was overcrowded under the bunks and that prisoners lay on the asphalt floor. I myself was imprisoned 7 years later in 1945, and it was just the same. But recently I received from MKB blank CH valuable personal testimony about overcrowding in the butyrki in 1918. In October of that year, during the second month of the Red Terror, it was so full that they even set up a cell for 70 women in the laundry. When, then, was the butyrki not crowded? It was Ivanov Razumnik who, in the Lubyanka reception kennel, calculated that for weeks at a time there were 3 persons for each square yard of floor space. Just as an experiment, try to fit 3 people into that space. But this, too, is no miracle. In the Vladimir internal prison in 1948, 30 people had to stand in a cell 10 feet by 10 feet in size. S. Potapov. In this kennel, there was neither ventilation nor a window, and the prisoner's body heat and breathing raised the temperature to 40 or 45 degrees centigrade, 104 to 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and everyone sat there in undershorts with their winter clothing piled beneath them. Their naked bodies were pressed against one another, and they got eczema from one another's sweat. They sat like that for weeks at a time, and were given neither fresh air nor water, except for gruel and tea in the morning. By and large, there is a good deal in Ivanov Razumnik's book that is superficial and personal, and there are many exhaustingly monotonous jokes. But the real life of the cells in the 1937 to 1938 period is very well described there. And if at the same time the latrine bucket replaced all other types of toilet, or if on the other hand there was no latrine bucket for use between trips to an outside toilet, as was the case in several Siberian prisons, and if 4 people ate from one bowl sitting on each other's knees, and if someone was hauled out for interrogation and then someone else was pushed in, beaten up, sleepless and broken, and if the appearance of such broken men was more persuasive than any threats on the part of the interrogators, and if by then death and any camp whatever seemed easier to a prisoner who had been left unsummoned for months than his tormented current situation. Perhaps this really did replace the theoretically ideal isolation in solitary. And you could not always decide in such a porridge of people with whom to be forthright, and you could not always find someone from whom to seek advice. And you would believe in the tortures and beatings not when the interrogator threatened you with them, but when you saw their results on other prisoners. You could learn from those who had suffered that they could give you a saltwater douche in the throat and then leave you in a box for a day tormented by thirst, karpunich. Or that they might scrape the skin off a man's back with a grater till it bled and then oil it with turpentine. Brigade Commander Rudolf Pintsov underwent both treatments. In addition, they pushed needles under his nails and poured water into him to the bursting point, demanding that he confess to having wanted to turn his brigade of tanks against the government during the November parade. In actual fact, he did lead his brigade at the parade, but for some reason he did not turn it against the government. But this was not taken into account. However, after these most varied tortures, he was sentenced to 10 years by the OSO. To that degree, the gendarmes themselves had no faith in their achievements. And from Alexandrov, the former head of the arts section of the All-Union Society for Cultural Relations with Foreign Countries, who has a broken spinal column which tilts to one side, and who cannot control his tear ducts and thus cannot stop crying, one can learn how Abakumov himself could beat in 1948. Yes, yes, Minister of State Security Abakumov himself did not by any means spurn such menial labor. A Suvorov at the head of his troops. He was not averse to taking a rubber truncheon in his hands every once in a while, and his deputy, Ryumin, was even more willing. He did this at Sukharovka in the General's interrogation office. The office had imitation walnut panelling on the walls, silk portières at the windows and doors, and a great Persian carpet on the floor. In order not to spoil all this beauty, a dirty runner, bespattered with blood, was rolled out on top of the carpet when a prisoner was being beaten. When Ryumin was doing the beating, he was assisted not by some ordinary guard, but by a colonel. "And so," said Ryumin politely, stroking his rubber truncheon, which was 4 centimeters, 1.5 inches thick, "you have survived trial by sleeplessness with honor." Alexander D. had cleverly managed to last a month without sleep, by sleeping while he was standing up. "So now we will try the club. Prisoners can't take more than 2 or 3 sessions of this. Let down your trousers and lie down on the runner." The colonel sat down on the prisoner's back. A.D. was going to count the blows. He didn't yet know about a blow from a rubber truncheon on the sciatic nerve when the buttocks have disappeared as a consequence of prolonged starvation. The effect is not felt in the place where the blow is delivered. It explodes inside the head. After the first blow, the victim was mad with pain and broke his nails on the carpet. Ryumin beat away, trying to hit accurately. The colonel pressed down on A.D.'s torso. This was just the right sort of work for 3 big shoulder-board stars assisting the all-powerful Ryumin. After the beating, the prisoner could not walk, and of course was not carried. They just dragged him along the floor. What was left of his buttocks was soon so swollen that he could not button his trousers, and yet there were practically no scars. He was hit by a violent case of diarrhea, and sitting there on the latrine bucket in solitary, A.D. guffawed. He went through a second and a third session, and his skin cracked, and Ryumin went wild and started to beat him on the stomach, breaking through the intestinal wall and creating an enormous hernia through which A.D.'s intestines protruded. The prisoner was taken off to the Butyrki hospital with a case of peritonitis, and for the time being their attempts to compel him to commit a foul deed were suspended. That is how they can torture you, too. After that it could seem a simple fatherly caress when the Kishinev interrogator Danilov beat Father Viktor Shipovalnikov across the back of the head with a poker and pulled him by his long hair. It is very convenient to drag a priest around in that fashion. Ordinary laymen can be dragged by the beard from one corner of the office to the other. And Richard Ohola, a Finnish Red Guard, and a participant in the capture of British agent Sidney Riley, and commander of a company during the suppression of the Kronstadt revolt, was lifted up with pliers, first by one end of his great moustaches, and then by the other, and held for 10 minutes with his feet off the floor. But the most awful thing they can do with you is this: undress you from the waist down, place you on your back on the floor, pull your legs apart, seat assistants on them from the glorious corps of sergeants, who also hold down your arms, and then the interrogator, and women interrogators are not shrunk from this, stands between your legs, and with the toe of his boot, or of her shoe, gradually, steadily, and with even greater pressure, crushes against the floor those organs which once made you a man. He looks into your eyes and repeats his questions, or the betrayal he is urging on you. If he does not press down too quickly, or just a shade too powerfully, you still have 15 seconds left in which to scream that you will confess to everything, that you are ready to see arrested all 20 of those people he's been demanding of you, or that you will slander in the newspapers everything you hold holy. And may you be judged by God, but not people. "There is no way out. You have to confess to everything," whisper the stoolies who have been planted in the cell. "It's a simple question. Hang on to your health," say people with common sense. "You can't get new teeth," those who have already lost them nod at you. "They're going to convict you in any case, whether you confess or whether you don't," conclude those who have got to the bottom of things. "Those who don't sign get shot," prophesies someone else in the corner, "out of vengeance, so as not to risk any leaks about how they conduct interrogations. And if you die in the interrogator's office, they'll tell your relatives you've been sentenced to camp without the right of correspondence, and then just let them look for you." If you are an orthodox communist, then another orthodox communist will sidle up to you, peering about with hostile suspicion, and he'll begin to whisper in your ear so that the uninitiated cannot overhear, "It's our duty to support Soviet interrogation. It's a combat situation. We ourselves are to blame. We were too soft-hearted. And now look at all the rot that is multiplied in the country. There is a vicious secret war going on. Even here we are surrounded by enemies. Just listen to what they are saying. The party is not obliged to account for what it does to every single one of us, to explain the whys and wherefores. If they ask us to, that means we should sign." And another orthodox communist sidles up. "I signed denunciations against 35 people, against all my acquaintances, and I advise you to drag along as many names as you can in your wake, as many as you can. That way it will become obvious that the whole thing is an absurdity, and they'll let everyone out." But that is precisely what the organs need, the conscientiousness of the orthodox communist and the purpose of the NKVD naturally coincide. Indeed, the NKVD needs just that arched fan of names, that fat multiplication of them. That is the mark of the quality of their work, and these are also new patches of woods in which to set out snares. "Your accomplices, accomplices, others who share your views." That is what they kept pressing to shake out of everyone. They say that R. Ralloff named Cardinal Richelieu as one of his accomplices, and that the cardinal was, in fact, so listed in his depositions. And no one was astonished by this until Ralloff was questioned about it at his rehabilitation proceedings in 1956. Apropos of the orthodox communists, Stalin was necessary for such a purge as that, yes, but a party like that was necessary too. The majority of those in power, up to the very moment of their own arrest, were pitiless in arresting others, obediently destroyed their peers in accordance with those same instructions, and handed over to retribution any friend or comrade in arms of yesterday. And all the big Bolsheviks, who now wear martyrs' halos, managed to be the executioners of other Bolsheviks, not even taking into account how all of them in the first place had been the executioners of non-communists. Perhaps 1937 was needed in order to show how little their whole ideology was worth, that ideology of which they boasted so enthusiastically, turning Russia upside down, destroying its foundations, trampling everything it held sacred underfoot. that Russia where they themselves had never been threatened by such retribution. The victims of the Bolsheviks from 1918 to 1946 never conducted themselves so despicably as the leading Bolsheviks when the lightning struck them. If you study in detail the whole history of the arrests and trials of 1936 to 1938, the principal revulsion you feel is not against Stalin and his accomplices, but against the humiliatingly repulsive defendants, nausea at their spiritual baseness after their former pride and implacability. So what is the answer? How can you stand your ground when you are weak and sensitive to pain, when people you love are still alive, when you are unprepared? What do you need to make you stronger than the interrogator and the whole trap? From the moment you go to prison, you must put your cozy past firmly behind you. At the very threshold, you must say to yourself, "My life is over, a little early to be sure, but there's nothing to be done about it. I shall never return to freedom. I am condemned to die, now or a little later. But later on, in truth, it will be even harder, and so the sooner the better. I no longer have any property whatsoever. For me, those I love have died, and for them I have died. From today on, my body is useless and alien to me. Only my spirit and my conscience remain precious and important to me." Confronted by such a prisoner, the interrogation will tremble. Only the man who has renounced everything can win that victory. But how can one turn one's body to stone? Well, they managed to turn some individuals from the Berdyaev circle into puppets for a trial, but they didn't succeed with Berdyaev. They wanted to drag him into an open trial. They arrested him twice. And in 1922, he was subjected to a night interrogation by Dzerzhinsky himself. Kamenev was there too, which means that he too was not averse to using the Cheka in an ideological conflict. But Berdyaev did not humiliate himself. He did not beg or plead. He set forth firmly those religious and moral principles which had led him to refuse to accept the political authority established in Russia. And not only did they come to the conclusion that he would be useless for a trial, but they liberated him. A human being has a point of view. N. Stoliarova recalls an old woman who was her neighbor on the Butyrki bunks in 1937. They kept on interrogating her every night. 2 years earlier, a former metropolitan of the Orthodox Church, who had escaped from exile, had spent a night at her home on his way through Moscow. "But he wasn't the former metropolitan. He was the metropolitan. Truly, I was worthy of receiving him." "All right, then. To whom did he go when he left Moscow?" "I know, but I won't tell you." The metropolitan had escaped to Finland via an underground railroad of believers. At first the interrogators took turns, and then they went after her in groups. They shook their fists in the little old woman's face, and she replied, "There is nothing you can do with me, even if you cut me into pieces. After all, you are afraid of your bosses, and you are afraid of each other, and you are even afraid of killing me." They would lose contact with the underground railroad. "But I am not afraid of anything. I would be glad to be judged by God right this minute." There were such people in 1937, too, people who did not return to their cell for their bundles of belongings, who chose death, who signed nothing denouncing anyone. One can't say that the history of the Russian revolutionaries has given us any better examples of steadfastness, but there is no comparison anywhere, because none of our revolutionaries ever knew what a really good interrogation could be, with 52 different methods to choose from. Sheshkovsky did not subject Radishev to torture, and because of contemporary custom, Radishev knew perfectly well that his sons would serve as officers in the Imperial Guard, no matter what happened to him, and that their lives wouldn't be cut short. Nor would anyone confiscate Radishev's family estate. Nonetheless, in the course of his brief 2-week interrogation, this outstanding man renounced his beliefs and his book and begged for mercy. Nicholas I didn't have enough imagination to arrest the wives of the Decembrists and compel them to scream in the interrogation room next door, or even to torture the Decembrists themselves. But in any case, he didn't need to. Even Ryleyev answered fully, frankly, and hid nothing. Even Pestel broke down and named comrades, who were still free, assigned to bury Ruskaya Pravda and the very place where it had been buried. In part, the reason for this was the same as in the case of Bukharin many years later. They were, after all, being interrogated by their social equals, their class brothers, and so their desire to explain everything was only natural. There were very few who, like Lunin, expressed disdain and contempt for the investigating commission. The majority behaved badly and got one another more deeply involved. Many of them begged abjectly to be pardoned. Zavalishin put all the blame on Ryleyev. Y.P. Obolensky and S.P. Trubetskoy couldn't wait to slander Griboyedov, which even Nicholas I didn't believe. Bakunin, in his confessions, abjectly grovelled before Nicholas I, thereby avoiding execution. Was this wretchedness of soul or revolutionary cunning? One would think that those who decided to assassinate Alexander II must have been people of the highest selflessness and dedication. After all, they knew what the stakes were. Grinevitsky shared the fate of the Tsar, but Rysakov remained alive and was held for interrogation. And that very day he blabbed on the participants in the plot and identified their secret meeting places. Out of fear for his young life, he rushed to give the government more information than he could ever have been suspected of having. He nearly choked with repentance. He proposed to expose all the secrets of the anarchists. At the end of the last century and the beginning of this one, the Tsarist interrogator immediately withdrew his question if the prisoner found it inappropriate or too intimate. But in Kresty prison in 1938, when the old political hard labor prisoner Zelensky was whipped with ramrods with his pants pulled down like a small boy, he wept in his cell. "My Tsarist interrogator didn't even dare address me rudely." Or, for example, we learn from recently published research that the Tsarist gendarme seized the manuscript of Lenin's essay, "What Are Our Ministers Thinking Of?" but were unable to get at its author. At the interrogation, the gendarmes, just as one might have expected, learned very little from the student Vanayev. The italics here and throughout the quotation are my own. He informed them only that the manuscripts found at his place had been brought to him in one package for safekeeping several days before the search by a certain person whom he did not wish to name. Therefore, the interrogator's sole alternative was to turn the manuscripts over for expert analysis. The experts learned nothing. What did he mean, his sole alternative? What about icy water up to the ankles, or a saltwater douche, or Ryumin's truncheon? It would seem that the author of this article, R. Peresvetov, himself served time for several years, and might easily have enumerated what alternatives the interrogator actually had when confronting the guardian of Lenin's "What Are Our Ministers Thinking Of?" As S.P. Melgunov recollects, "That was a Tsarist prison, a prison of blessed memory, which political prisoners nowadays can only recall with a feeling almost of gladness." But that is a case of displaced concepts. The yardstick is totally different. Just as ox-cart drivers of Gogol's time could not have imagined the speed of a jet plane, those who have never gone through the receiving line meat grinder of Gulag cannot grasp the true possibilities of interrogation. We read in Izvestia for May the 24th, 1959, that Yulipa Rumyantseva was confined in the internal prison of a Nazi camp while they tried to find out from her the whereabouts of her husband, who had escaped from that same camp. She knew, but she refused to tell. For a reader who is not in the know, this is a model of heroism. For a reader with a bitter gulag past, it's a model of inefficient interrogation. Yulia did not die under torture, and she was not driven insane. A month later, she was simply released, still very much alive and kicking. All these thoughts about standing firm as a rock were quite unknown to me in February 1945. Not only was I not in the least prepared to cut my cozy ties with Earth, I was even quite angry for a long time because 100 or so Faber pencils had been taken away from me when I was arrested. looking back on my interrogation from my long subsequent imprisonment, I had no reason to be proud of it. I might have borne myself more firmly, and in all probability I could have manoeuvred more skilfully. But my first weeks were characterized by a mental blackout and a slump into depression. The only reason these recollections do not torment me with remorse is that, thanks be to God, I avoided getting anyone else arrested, but I came close to it. Although we were frontline officers, Nikolai V. and I, who were involved in the same case, got ourselves into prison through a piece of childish stupidity. He and I corresponded during the war between two sectors of the front, and though we knew perfectly well that wartime censorship of correspondence was in effect, we indulged in fairly outspoken expressions of our political outrage and in derogatory comments about the wisest of the wise, whom we labelled with the transparently obvious nickname of Pakan, or Ringleader of the Thieves. When, later on, I reported our case in various prisons, our naivete aroused only laughter and astonishment. Other prisoners told me that two more such stupid jackasses couldn't exist, and I became convinced of it myself. Then, suddenly, one day, reading some documents on the case of Alexander Ulyanov, Lenin's elder brother, I learned that he and his confederates got caught in exactly the same way, a careless exchange of letters. And that was the only reason Alexander III didn't die on March the 1st, 1887. A member of the group, Andreyushkin, sent a frank letter to his friend in Kharkov. "I am firmly convinced that we are going to have the most merciless terror, and in the fairly near future, too. Red terror is my hobby. I am worried about my addressee. If he gets it, then I may get it too, and that would be unfortunate, because I will drag in a lot of very effective people." It was not the first such letter he had written, and the unhurried search this letter initiated continued for 5 weeks, via Kharkov, in order to discover who in St. Petersburg had written it. Andreyushkin's identity was not established until February the 28th. On March the 1st, the bomb throwers, bombs in hand, were arrested on Nevsky Prospect just before the attempted assassination. The office of my interrogator, I.I. Yetsepov, was high-ceilinged, spacious and bright, with an enormous window. The Rossiya Insurance Company had not been built with torture in mind. And, putting to use its 17 feet of height, a full-length, vertical, 13-foot portrait of that powerful sovereign hung there, toward whom I, grain of sand that I was, had expressed my hatred. Sometimes the interrogator stood in front of the portrait and declaimed dramatically, "We are ready to lay down our lives for him. We are ready to lay down in the path of oncoming tanks for his sake." Face to face with the altar-like grandeur of that portrait, my mumbling about some kind of purified Leninism seemed pitiful, and I myself seemed a blasphemous slanderer deserving only death. The contents of our letters provided more than enough, in keeping with the standards of those times, to sentence us both. Therefore my interrogator did not have to invent anything. He merely tried to cast his noose around everyone I had ever written to or received a letter from. I had expressed myself vehemently in letters to friends my own age, and had been almost reckless in spelling out seditious ideas, but my friends, for some reason, had continued to correspond with me. And some suspicious phrases could be found in their replies to my letters. One of our school friends was nearly arrested because of me at this time. It was an enormous relief to me to learn later that he was still free. But then, 22 years later, he wrote to me, "On the basis of your published works, I conclude that you take a one-sided view of life. Objectively speaking, you have become the standard-bearer of fascist reactionaries in the West, in West Germany and the United States, for example. Lenin, whom I'm convinced you love and honor just as much as you used to, yes, and old Marx and Engels, too, would have condemned you in the severest fashion. Think about that." Indeed, I do think about that. How sorry I am that you didn't get arrested then. How much you lost. And then Yezepov, like Porfiry Petrovich, demanded that I explain it all in a coherent way. If we had expressed ourselves in such a fashion in letters that we knew were subject to censorship, what could we have said to each other face to face? I could not convince him that all my fire-eating talk was confined to my letters. And at that point, with muddled mind, I had to undertake to weave something credible about my meetings with my friends, meetings referred to in my letters. What I said had to jibe with the letters in such a way as to be on the very edge of political matters, and yet not fall under that criminal code. Moreover, these explanations had to pour forth quickly, all in one breath, so as to convince this veteran interrogator of my naivete, my humility, my total honesty. The main thing was not to provoke my lazy interrogator to any interest in looking through that accursed load of stuff I had brought in my accursed suitcase, including many notebooks of my war diary, written in hard,